Happy February and happy Valentine's Day to our Talk Public Health followers. We are pleased to share with you a very special gift, our second episode of Talk Public Health Season 2021. I guess you're wondering, what makes this particular episode more special than any other? And why is this being called Episode 2? Well, firstly, because our last episode on the Sheffield World Health Organization Simulation, or SHEFU, was bonus content. And two, well, we did promise in our first episode of Season 2021 that we had some fresh ideas and unfinished business from last year, to which we are adding a bit of a pandemic twist. And this episode is that twist. Naomi, Annie, and I recorded this episode in March 2020 as the entire world was beginning to grapple with a rapidly evolving COVID-19 pandemic. Context have changed, but some things for the better or worse have not. We are releasing this episode as a sort of throwback to that time. Were we right? Were we wrong? What would we have said or done differently with the knowledge we have now? Well, we'll delve into those issues in our next live recording, which will drop on our various podcasts and social media channels at the end of February/early March. In the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode as we discuss tales from the COVID-19 frontline.
Hello, everyone, and we welcome you back to another episode of Talk Public Health, where we're going to dive into this very special episode with the whole Talk Public Health team. So that's myself, Naomi, and Annie, as we address the topic of the coronavirus, or COVID-19 as it's officially called. But before we begin, we want to share that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Talk Public Health, our sponsors, supporters, or employers. And of particular importance to this episode, persons should take official advice and guidance from their local health authorities and government around COVID-19. As we said before, the entire Talk Public Health team is going to be on this podcast episode as we share our experience as public health practitioners and how it's been influenced by the COVID-19 pandemic. So on this podcast episode, you have myself, Naomi, and Annie. I really want to be able to quickly dive into what everyone is doing and how is COVID-19 influencing your work. So anyone, take the reign, take the microphone.
Okay, me. So hi, everyone. This is Annie. You might not know my voice. I don't talk as much on this podcast, but I also graduated from the Masters of Public Health alongside Charles and Naomi, and I'm also a clinician. I am a GP. At the moment, I am working for New South Wales Health, which is basically the state health department of New South Wales, which is the most populous state of Australia. And I am working for the Communicable Diseases Health Protection Branch in the incident room that we've set up for this public health emergency that is COVID-19. So very much on the groundwork, taking phone calls of new notifications, figuring out details of, you know, where each case has been, where they might have acquire the disease from, tracing all of their contacts, making sure they don't spread it to anyone else. I've actually become a bit of a school specialist in that all of the schools, positive notifications at schools are getting forwarded through to me, and I'm liaising with the Department of Education about closing schools, about finding other students. So it's actually quite unpredictable and, yes, a very busy time at the moment.
So it's Naomi here, and currently I'm interning with the Regional Office for Europe, the WHO Regional Office for Europe, and working with the Health Systems Governance Program. Not much hands-on work with COVID-19, but yes, some policy-related stuff and health systems lens towards looking at the incident. So, yeah.
So I guess you're looking at it from a much higher level than I am, Naomi. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
And I guess for me, I am, I guess, working in two roles. I'm working as a climate change consultant, and I'm also doing some health security work here in the Caribbean. And so both of these roles are being impacted by this pandemic, particularly as we need to be able to, be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So, you know, there are very, very important issues like climate change that need to continue to be addressed and reporting around that to the UN. At the same time, trying to really ensure that countries in the Caribbean are able to have their core competencies around international health regulations strengthened. So I'm also looking forward to this podcast and this episode.
Just Charles, you mentioned something quite interesting. Walk and chew gum. Is that a new term? Because I've never heard of it. Is it walk in the park or walk and chew gum? What does that mean? I think it's quite interesting.
right. Like the term is just being able to, so it is walk and chew gum at the same time. So just ensuring that all systems are able to function even while you have something important placed in front of you. Yes, we have a pandemic going on, but other systems of government still need to be able to function, even at the basic level. You may not be able to function at 100%, but different aspects of your government need to be able to respond. And so I'm just trying to see how we can continue to address important crises and emergencies like climate change, while also, you know, ensuring that we take are guided by good public health practice in addressing COVID-19.
That's true. I'm actually imitating walking and chewing gum now, so it makes all sense.
Are you walking, Naomi?
I'm actually sitting and pretending to walk and gum, so it does make sense. Yeah, thank you, Charles, for the explanation.
No worries at all. So I think that what we want to try and do for this episode is see if we're going to level the playing field around COVID-19, because there are some persons who are working deeply in it and those who aren't that are involved and maybe listening to this podcast. And then we're going to delve into some discussion points that we think may have been generated from us and from the dialogue happening online, social media, through working around, such as, you know, maybe the pros and cons in our relation to implementation of IHR, whether there is issues in terms of inequities, how is COVID-19 being communicated, and the politics around it, and how exactly do we move forward from here? So I think what's probably a good place to start is delving into what exactly is COVID-19. And I welcome any of our team to maybe just give a quick overview about, like, what is COVID-19?
I would say Annie should, like, enlighten us, because she's, like, the practicing GP at the moment. So.
COVID-19 is the other word for coronavirus, and I hope that listeners would have come across this term at some point in the last few weeks, because it seems like it is everywhere. But it's essentially a respiratory disease that's caused by a new virus that we hadn't known about before, and we first found out about this new virus through a few cases in China, where people were becoming quite sick, and this brand new virus was isolated from them. And since then, we have gotten to know this virus a lot better, but since then also we have seen the spread of this virus around the world. So, like I said, it's a respiratory illness. So it's from So you catch it from coughing and sneezing, and it causes mostly respiratory symptoms. So like cold-like, flu-like symptoms, or some cases are very, very mild, which doesn't help with us detecting that someone has it. But some cases are very severe, and there have been thousands of global deaths from COVID-19 as well.
So who is most at risk for like COVID-19, Annie? And I know that there's also been conversations of how to like reduce its spread. I've been seeing a lot of videos being done about people being told not to touch their face. I've been trying to actually like take track of how many times I touch my face and also properly washing hands. But perhaps you can just give a little bit more information about how is it spread and like who is most at risk for this illness.
Yeah, it's interesting when you ask about who is most at risk, because that feeds into the whole risk communication thing that we're going to talk about later. In that when you ask a question of who is most at risk, there are actually different types of risk that we need to talk about. So there are people who are most at risk of catching the disease, mm-hmm. people who are most at risk of passing the disease on to other people, mm-hmm. and people who are most at risk of having severe complications from the disease. And they may be that may be three different groups, but when we talk about people at risk, sometimes we get them confused, and that can sometimes be a bit confusing for the public as well. So the people who are most at risk of catching the disease are the people who, I guess, have the most exposure to people coughing and sneezing. Mm-hmm. So people who work with a lot of other people, especially in crowded environments. But the people who we worry the most about spreading it to other people are healthcare workers, because you know, they work with a lot of very vulnerable populations at close distances. But in terms of people who are most at risk of having severe disease, what we found are that the people who are elderly mm-hmm. And already have a lot of other illnesses, they tend to be the ones who end up in the intensive care unit, who might end up dying from the disease. And obviously, also, if you look at bigger groups, there are certain countries where people are more at risk of dying of COVID-19 just because the systems in the country, the health systems, are less able to support someone who is unwell. So there are many things to think about when we think about risk.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that you mentioned health systems. I got quite excited there in terms of the talk about them supporting. I mean, this is quite an interesting thing, and I hope we'll look at it, the fact that health systems, even in Western countries, are panicking that they cannot afford or even provide services with the way the trends of the pandemic are going. So I look forward to us.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny how it's only when something like this happens that you realize that there are so many gaps and flaws in so many healthcare systems that we thought were pretty good to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually think that this has actually brought up a pretty good point about inequalities, right? We've talked about how even health systems in what we deem the global north are and that have been shown as like beacons of like good systems are concerned, or there's inequities that are being exposed. So I guess, how do you all feel about the topic of like inequalities around COVID-19 and how they're being brought to light in the face of this pandemic?
So I guess what I would say is that in our historical narratives, for example, around the plague, it's been called the Great Leveler because people believe that epidemics sort of reduce the inequalities between the rich and the poor, and that, you know, we see the rich and famous get infected as well as just your everyday person, and viruses don't discriminate. But really, I think that's a narrative that I definitely don't agree with. And the more I work on the ground, the more inequalities I've been seeing, even among just my state that I'm dealing with, let alone around the world. And there are inequalities at so many different levels.
So I think that that you've brought up this a really interesting point, Annie, which I think that we're going to definitely end up addressing at a later point in the episode, is that we're hearing stories about high-profile persons, prime ministers, high-level government officials, and celebrities being suspected cases and self-isolating, or like being quarantined due to COVID-19. So it's showing that even though persons may have access to healthcare and the monetary means to do so, the virus isn't really discriminating against anybody. And I think that COVID-19, I think, has really helped to expose some of the very arguments that form the core of like public health practice, particularly around access to universal health care and universal health coverage, and being able to invest strongly within our health services and our health workforce. And I think that, I feel like I pick on them every single episode, but like, you know, when you think about the US, for example, and you're hearing stories about people being charged like thousands of dollars to get COVID-19 screening, or to be able to, or staying at work because there's no paid leave, being concerned about missing work because their work is tied to their insurance. What does this mean in terms of being able to have disease control and surveillance when you're having these inequalities in place that's impacting, you know, the working class and whatnot?
I mean, Charles, you just brought up like a really good point in terms of like talking about insurance has been linked to presence of work. I mean, I would not disclose, but I guess it's that attitude of when people, even being sick, they still have to go, and we are in a situation whereby you should not go to work, and because of this clause that your work is tied to your health, securities and other things, that people regardless still go to work, and this is the situation we are seeing with COVID. So that's something we should actually pick on, because how do we promote universal health coverage if people feel the need that regardless of their health status, they should still attend a job place, like because of the things they would miss out if they don't. So I'm trying to coin this.
Yeah, that employment is linked so tightly with access to healthcare that you just have to go to work, definitely. And the other thing that I've been seeing on the ground is that here in New South Wales, we have public schools and we have private schools, and we have had outbreaks in both. And just my experiences of helping the schools temporarily close, advising the students who are close contacts that they need to self-quarantine, is that it's so much easier in a private school than a public school. Even closing the school and advising parents that they need to pick their children up, in a private school, the parents are there, you know, within 2 hours, kids get picked up, the school gets emptied. In a public school, parents will go, oh, well, I can't, I have to finish work, you know, I can't just leave work. In a private school, parents can take time off, can work from home, can supervise their children when they're under quarantine. In a public school, parents are going, well, I don't have a job where I can work from home. Like, I need to be at work, and I don't have the financial means to organize childcare for my child. So this child is at home unsupervised and supposedly under quarantine, but you don't know if they're running out of the door or not, because mm-hmm. there's no adult looking after them. So even that alone just highlights the inequalities that are involved in this epidemic.
Yeah, but I think that also makes us to think, because I know that there have always been discourses on how millennials keep talking about working from home and all those policies, but it's I see the opportunity here as well for us to redefine our normal way of thinking with work policies and the rest. So in as much as these inequalities are really evident, it's also giving us ways to think moving forward. How do we operate better in a changing world, I would say?
Around like remote working practices. I know that like for a fact, I had shared a article that was basically getting to the point, pandemic or not, remote work is here to stay.
Exactly.
And that we need to be able to adapt at all levels. How do we ensure, whether it's remote work or flexible work or flexi time, these type of initiatives that are required for people to be able to have both work-life balance, but also be able to utilize the flexibility for work in the case of a pandemic. But I guess, Annie, I'd also like to delve a little bit into this whole issue around like testing, right? I know that I'm sure that all of us and viewers may be paying attention, and I'm sorry that it sounds like I have a U.S. focus. It's just that, you know, I'm in the Bahamas. The U.S. is my next door neighbor, and so what they do there strongly influences what happens here. But there's a narrative going on about testing and whether or not it's feasible to go about testing every single person, and whether or not having access to testing in the first place is vital for being able to control COVID-19. And even here in the Bahamas, you're seeing where it was discussed that we currently have a population of about 400,000, and we have a couple hundred test kits. But people are like, how is that supposed to work? We have millions of people who travel here as tourists, and you also have 400,000 people that live here. Why do we only have a couple hundred test kits? And so, like, I'd like to open up the discourse a bit around that. Like, is there an inequality issue around access to testing? Like, taking aside the financial part or what resources healthcare systems can get, because clearly the U.S. doesn't have enough, and we don't have enough.
I mean, that's something that I would commend Italy for. I remember when Italy started having a lot of cases, people were saying that it's just because they are testing enough and trying to really get to the root cause. And I mean, that also helped them to identify the urgency of this pandemic. So having access to testing itself, I would say, if you look at the case of Italy, led to the more discovery, the more quick actions and helping at least to curb the disease. So the decisions that we make to like close the borders, to restrict travel, etc. So in a situation whereby like there's not enough kits, for like you mentioned in the Bahamas, and I would also quickly talk about Nigeria now, where I'm from, makes it a bit problematic to address or to contain the pandemic. And I'm actually quite surprised that US is having that situation. Maybe you could say more about that, Charles, a bit later. So in case of Nigeria, like where I'm from, I would say one of the issues the health system is having is resources to even get the kids to test people. So the problem is like, okay, we have one case. Of course, a pandemic like this is just not possible to have one case. And then after a period of a week, you say you have two cases. I just see that as a problem of access to testing. So people are not getting tested. And then a country like mine, Nigeria, cannot afford a pandemic if they're already struggling with a Lassa fever outbreak. So definitely there is inequality in terms of getting access to testing in which regards to how I would say the health system infrastructure in place is. And in the case of the US, I'm just surprised because I would expect the CDC to be able to contain that. For the Bahamas, I guess you can say more. And maybe Annie can share more about South Wales. And
yeah, well, I guess the best way for a country to have zero cases is to not test, right? The testing numbers definitely drive up your case numbers. Mm-hmm. But I guess the other thing that has been a bit of a maybe public communication issue is that what we do in terms of testing is actually fluid during an outbreak, in that at the beginning maybe you want to be able to find every single case, but then later on the epidemic when we have so many people who are infected, we actually keep changing our criteria for who should get tested, and we actually need to maybe narrow down our focus of testing a little bit more, and also as we learn about the disease. And that kind of day-to-day change, especially in a fast-moving epidemic, can be quite difficult to communicate to the public who, you know, hear more and more about the disease and suddenly everyone wants to be tested. And even just to be able to communicate to the public that because you are symptomatic today and you got a test today saying that you're negative, it doesn't mean that maybe you need to be retested 2 weeks mm-hmm. later, because then you now have symptoms and you might have caught it from somebody else. So I guess that is something to think about. But the other thing that we also need to think about is that we are actually now facing a worldwide shortage of reagents. That yep. even in a country where we are testing a lot, like Australia, we still want to test quite broadly, and we also have a fairly small population, we're now having to look at changing our testing policy just because we just don't have enough reagent to test. And sorry for the people who aren't who don't have a healthcare or a scientific background, but reagents, basically the liquid that the test needs to react with in order to for the test to run, to so that we know whether or not the case is positive or negative for coronavirus. So we definitely need enough of that in the laboratory to be able to run the tests.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's been some critiques of systems that may have been dismantled, Naomi, in the US, for why kits weren't brought out quickly enough, and the response to it, in terms of trying to protect markets versus public health. But I don't claim to be a expert of the US's pandemic response, and so I'll leave that for people to be able to read up on and whatnot. But I definitely think that I am a bit concerned about the narrative. Again, I don't want to delve into the media yet, but there is a narrative that every single person should be able to be tested for coronavirus. And for me as a public health person, and maybe I'll leave that to you all to decide whether or not you agree or disagree, I don't think it's feasible to be able to test every single person during a outbreak of this kind, because as it stands right now, personally, how we see a pandemic has been declared, it's anticipated that your country will have cases of those diseases, whether or not they are asymptomatic or not. And given that, in terms of surveillance, countries are probably capturing those cases that are more severe and critical in their screening, at what point are you going to be... There isn't unlimited funding available to develop reagents to screen 8 billion people on the planet times two. Because let's just assume that you are tested negative today, and my concern is if you get tested as negative, that you suddenly decrease your risk aversion to doing and implementing initiatives to prevent either contact, those social distancing, or whatnot, because you say, I'm fine, right? And then you contract the disease later. Like, what do you all think about that? Do you think it's that I'm being, like, unreasonable? How do we communicate that to the public? Because I'm seeing people who are, like, typing in bold caps online. Why aren't we testing everybody? What's wrong? You guys are irresponsible.
I mean, that ties really into, like, the next thing, maybe, on health systems' ability to cope with this pandemic. And I would say, of course, Charles, you should understand that everybody is in a state of hysteria, in a state of panic. And I would give kudos to all the zombie apocalypse movies we have that have been, staring people up. So I do agree with you. I do not think, like, any health system in the world has the capacity to test everybody. And that's why we have to start talking about high quality surveillance mechanisms. Like, the people that are prone more to be infected should be tested, or people that have been exposed. And I mean, we have to communicate that in telling people that you should just, I think, maybe talking about solidarity, or like the fact that we how do I coin this now? I would say the fact that you should think about the other people around you, and also try to be more empathic and try to be understanding that we just don't live in the world where we have the resources to treat everybody. And if you're not exposed, and if you do not have symptoms or come across anybody that has been quarantined or in isolation, then there is no just need for you to get tested. Just do the hygienic measures and as social distances. Maybe we should also talk about that at some point. But just let's be real with people. Let's speak their language and just be like, there's no need for it. And I know the main issue here is fear. So we have to talk about communicating to people in the context of fear and panic, and trying to get for them to understand that there's no need.
People think about people like me, obviously, in medicine, we always say that you don't order a test unless you do something about it afterwards. And so poor people like me are having to do something afterwards every time that there's a positive result. So even being empathic towards your healthcare workers who are now having to do all the contact tracing, I'm getting exhausted, and people at work are getting sick and not coming to work and self-isolating just to make sure that they're not making everyone else sick. So we're having a dwindling workforce as well. Like, it would just not be sustainable.
I completely agree.
It's good that you mentioned that, because one of the things, again, with the health systems lens, it's like having healthcare workers being understaffed, because as you just said, and a simple exposure would mean that we quarantine a healthcare worker, and we just don't have enough people. We already had issues with like understaffing of doctors, nurses, and then with this pandemic, we do not automatically have enough doctors that will tailor to everybody. So I mean, and that's what goes back to the context of people just being
empathetic.
Empathetic, and also just trying to understand that this is not an apocalypse. Try to get themselves informed. There are a lot of information from the World Health Organization, so getting access to the right information is important. And just, knowing how the disease works, and not going all panicky and trying to get tests when it's not necessary for them.
I think one thing that we've at least noticed in terms of media and healthcare staffing capacity is that at the moment we actually don't have the human resources to follow up on recoveries for each case, and so we don't actually have enough data to generate or the good news stories of people who get better, actually, because we're so busy chasing up on new cases. And so that kind of shapes the media narrative as well, that we're just seeing all of these increasing numbers of people getting sick, but we're not seeing increasing numbers of people who, you know, got diagnosed and actually got better later on and are actually now probably immune to the virus, getting the virus again, at least for a short time, because we have discovered persisting antibodies that turn up. Yeah.
So I guess let's delve a little bit into this whole media bit. But before I pivot to that, I also wanted to talk a little bit about the health systems lens in terms of particularly our health workforce, who really should be applauded for their commitment to protecting population health and like really, you know, putting their health and well-being on the line. And the health workers who are in countries that have seen the hardest hit, in China and Italy, where we're seeing some harrowing media stories. But I just wanted to like bring up here in terms of the health workforce, when we have health workforce members that need to step back because they're either self-isolating or they're getting burnt out, and we're talking about having to do social distancing, and people kind of assume that doctors make money, but I can speak from a Bahamas perspective. Doctors don't, maybe not specialist doctors, but GPs, persons that are starting up, they're not making a lot of money. And if schools close and social distancing has to be done and they're working around the clock, how is the support for healthcare workers and their families who also have to be impacted by the decisions that they're taking, right, in terms of either recommending school closures or for isolation at home or for anything like that? Like, is there anything that you all want to add to that like narrative? Because I've thought about that recently. The nurses, the doctors, everybody else who also have to deal with the implications of their family members having to deal with some of the strict measures around COVID-19.
I mean, I think that's a good point to look at it from, Charles. I do not know if people are actually considering that. There should be, of course, mechanisms put in place to take care of our healthcare workers, given the fact that this is not only bringing a lot of pressure, but also high chance of getting burned out, high chance of getting infected themselves. But I have actually not seen much more on talking about the protection or the protective mechanism for healthcare workforce. I'm sure there is something somewhere, but I'm not sure. Annie, what do you think about
that? Well, I think it exposes the fact that just in general, in the background, there isn't so much support for healthcare workers, and where it is available, it is patchy. So, for example, at my workplace, they're now putting forward a bit more of an employment assistance program. And luckily, I come from a rich health system where working in the COVID response, we at least get our lunches and dinners provided, so that at least we don't have to, you know, go home exhausted and then having to cook and having to spend time doing other life things. But that's only really at my workplace, and it really depends on every workplace to recognize that and provide that. But you know, there's always this heightened anxiety amongst healthcare workers as well, that what if I get it, then that means that not only do I have to step back from my role, but then all of these patients are going to be impacted, and it's quite a heavy responsibility to carry on your shoulders. And I guess, just a huge shout out to healthcare workers around the world who are working on this. That's how it has been.
That's just
as an example. Yeah,
exactly.
Very good example, and I also see it here, like the emergency team at the WHO, like they are working around the clock, even though like some of us are working remotely. They are there trying to get to countries, and like so you then see there's so much. You have to really love what you're doing to be able to give that much you know, passion, attention to it. But to some extent, we healthcare workers do not get the credit for what they're doing. And maybe that's something we have to change. And I mean, somebody, there was a paper, I think one article I recently saw on how it was saying maybe coronavirus is finally giving public health the voice it needs so that people should understand the importance of public health. And I thought that was also moving forward to say public health, but also our healthcare workers that are giving up their lives to really make us feel better and live in a more safe world health-wise. Yeah.
But in a way, I think the more cynical part of me is going, really, in the eyes of media from this point onwards, it just doesn't seem, and maybe it's because I'm, you know, in the middle of such hard work that I have this pessimistic view that no matter what we do now as public health physicians, we can still be portrayed as having failed in the eyes of the media, because it really depends on how it's all framed. That, you know, like, are the public expecting that for us to succeed, there should be no new cases from this point onwards? You know, like, I guess people don't appreciate that there is a curve that goes up and then goes down, and maybe we've cut the curve in half in terms of number of cases, but you're still going to see so many deaths and cases, and so people wouldn't necessarily appreciate that if there weren't healthcare workers who are working hard, that maybe the situation could actually be a lot worse. I don't know if I'm phrasing it correctly, that people get what I'm talking about, but so much of it is in the media framing and in managing public expectations as well. Yeah.
Yes. I think let's delve into the media and this risk communication bit.
Yeah, because let's go there.
Yeah. I think that that's what's really playing a big role around how COVID-19 is being addressed. I know that a few points that we wanted to get over is one, COVID-19. Did we take too long to actually name the virus? I think a good question is, did we allow the term Wuhan virus to stay in the media for too long, and did that create any issues in terms of how people are placing blame or fault? Go ahead.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know us personally, I am of Chinese background, and my grandparents are actually currently living in Wuhan, so it makes things very interesting. But working clinically as a GP, I definitely experience the racial aspects of this epidemic, the discriminatory side of things. And for me, just the fact that it has been called the Wuhan virus for so long, it really doesn't help with even just the way that how well I can provide healthcare to patients, because they see me as a healthcare practitioner through that lens, and all of a sudden it changes my relationship and my interaction with a patient in terms of how much they trust my advice. So it definitely has public health implications in that way too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's definitely difficult, Annie, and I couldn't imagine that, to be honest. And I don't think that's a narrative that people have really considered in terms of the healthcare workers of Asian descent, and even persons who may have family members or whatnot that may have faced some type of discrimination based on the naming of a virus, and people placing blame on China for the spread of the virus, because I'm not going to get into all of the like narratives there on how people think it was spread and like whatnot. We can probably share some links around that to debunk about how COVID-19 has been spread. But I don't know. Naomi, you, what do you think? Do you think it's like we took too long to put forward a name? I don't pretend to be an expert on how quickly a name is categorized, but what do
I
you think?
In as much as it's not the problem of taking too long, I think the naming came with the result of like looking at the epidemiological aspect of the virus, so trying to understand what it was. And so that did cause a lot of delay. I would say the problem in itself was attaching it to a place. So it would have been the name wouldn't have been really drawn from the city, because people didn't really think about the repercussions of that. It was more like, okay, it came from Wuhan, let's just name it the Wuhan virus. But I think we as a scientific community or as public health people really should have thought more in terms of the repercussion of aligning the name of the disease with the place. Because as Annie was saying, it led to a lot of like fear, or as we'll talk about later, racism and like it's just like a lot of bad reactions to people from Asia, not even Wuhan itself. Mm-hmm. So I would say, as a scientific community, something to learn maybe in the future. We could have called it something else, maybe mm-hmm. a virus X or mm-hmm. something, mm-hmm. not like attaching and accepting the name with mm-hmm. its place of origin. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying virus X or Z virus or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, then I guess like the other like narrative here, and I think like, you know, Annie, you've like delved into it about like, I think there was a meme going around. I get it. We're in a generation of memes to try and like cope with things. Right. But there was a meme going around in talking about public health, and that sometimes we need to operate in a way in which we are seen to be overreacting, because when we overreact, sometimes nothing happens, and that's mm-hmm. a good thing. But if we don't overreact, people then say that you didn't do enough. And I guess people are kind of weighing in the media, did we not move quickly enough? I'm saying collectively, we as public health persons, we as like governments around the world, did we not move fast enough to take stronger public health measures? And will anybody really care about the amount of deaths that have been averted from mm-hmm. public health interventions, but only look at the gross numbers? Because I know I've received some backlash about it, where I've tried to compare the severity and the infectiousness of COVID-19 to other illnesses that are vaccine preventable and have some historical trends, and people are like, do not tell me to calm down, and do not try to like, you know, downplay this because it's killing people. And I get that, but I don't know. I'm just trying to get at the fact that is the media to blame? Like I feel bad because I like straddle this world where I do work in communications from a public health perspective, and so I feel like they do work hard, but I'm wondering, where did the failure, or where did the managing expectations fail, right? Did we not have enough good risk communication in place to try and like manage expectations? Did we not do a good job at coordinating communications? Will anybody care that we've probably averted thousands of more deaths, but they don't see those interventions and what we've done?
But I think that's a good question, Charles, because I know Annie mentioned it earlier. If you actually look at the number of recovered cases from COVID-19, it's quite a high number. So mm-hmm. we are not doing, I think, justice in not highlighting that. So at the moment, of course, there's still a lot of uncertainty. I mean, I usually connote people's panic and fear to the uncertainty of the virus itself. So if the WHO is saying, we still do not have a vaccine, we still do not have a cure, but this is what you should do, the only thing people are hearing is, there's no cure for this thing, you know? And people are not, I think it's the way we give the message, and that's what you talk about, communication. So maybe we should do much more. I was doing this short communication course, and like, what is the, how do people perceive it? And just for this example I gave, all people are concentrating on is the fact that there's no cure for this thing yet, or there's no vaccine for it yet. But they are not saying, okay, why are people getting recovered? What are we doing right? So maybe we should do more in terms of highlighting that, okay, this is an uncertain case, this is a new disease nobody knows about, but people have survived and they went through so, 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 and so. So let's do this. So maybe that's a way we should maybe redefine our communication style and try to highlight that more. But I would not say that it's something that would change a lot now, because we kind of missed it maybe at some point.
I think it also just ties into the fact that in general, people want to feel like they can do something about something. And mm-hmm. what we're telling people is that there's not much you can do besides washing your hands, and yeah. people are like, oh my god, that's really all I can do to prevent me from getting this. And so I think that is why, you know, one of the reasons that at least here it's driving people into stockpiling supermarket groceries in a panic, because at least that feels like it's something that I can do mm-hmm. to prepare for this thing. Because just washing your hands all the time seems a bit pathetic as well.
Yeah. I mean, people yeah. want to hear something more difficult, you know?
Yeah.
It's simple. It's crazy with people that actually we should maybe look into this. Some maybe psychologists should do a research on why people tend to accept simple messages, but when it comes to preventative measures, there's simple things seem too simple. You know, it's like, no, it's not possible for me to just wash my hands. I need to hear more. But then if you tell them, oh, something as silly as hot climate, COVID does not survive in hot climate, they're like, ah, that's true. Like in Nigeria, that's the rumor that is going on. We just chill. Doesn't come here. So things like that.
Go ahead.
And I think we also need to think about the fact that, you know, we're definitely not, I mean, this is the elephant in the room, right, that we're not in an environment where it's just traditional media anymore. We really need to think about what's happening on social media. And yeah. I think just in general, as healthcare practitioners, we're not very good at this whole social media messaging thing, where we're a bit scared of it. And I think that doesn't help when it comes to events like pandemics.
Mm-hmm. But Charles, I would like to hear from you. You're a communications
guy. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're just talking, me and Annie, and like, ooh.
Yeah, so yeah. But, you know, Charles is very comfortable with social media. And
exactly.
So we need people like him. But think about your average 60-year-old consultant who doesn't even have a smartphone, right? Yeah.
I don't do Facebook. I don't need that. You know, that's what they tell you. Like, what?
Yeah.
Google Drive. So yeah, definitely, Charles.
I've come to appreciate how useful social media can be, but also how harmful it can be at the same time. And I think that if there's one thing that needs to come out of this, and I know that we always, you know, do things in retrospect, we need more health persons trained in digital media and social media and understanding how to navigate traditional media and getting risk communication training. Because I remember having the same debate with public health folks way before this outbreak, about is it the public health practitioner's responsibility to provide key messages to the media for them to communicate to the public and to be more engaged with the media. And I was surprised to get an overwhelming no, that is not their job. It's the media's job to to sort mm-hmm. through the information that's provided by the health practitioners, and wow. then come back to verify for information. And I'm like, don't you think wow. that's a wow. bit of a disservice to
exactly.
do that?
With our because, complex language.
Yeah.
Right. Well, right. Sorry.
I guess to give you a counterexample, though, at the moment in our COVID bunker, actually pretty much probably almost half or maybe even over half of the bunker is actually like the staffing that's actually dedicated to public messaging and media. And we actually have a team that drafts all of the public statements and then a separate team for dissemination, just mm-hmm. because we need so much manpower. And we're really recognizing that in order for us to be successful in controlling this outbreak, the public needs accurate, timely information. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. we actually have so much of our human resources dedicated just to communications.
Exactly. And I think that is a key component of like the IHR, right? Having like a team in place for like dealing with communications with the public and dispelling rumors. But I think that like I'm even thinking even far reaching than just COVID-19. I think in general, communications needs to be embedded within the healthcare, within the public health and health workforce curriculum, competencies, right?
Yeah.
Competencies, and competencies yeah. for moving forward, and not just seeing it as this is some artsy thing or this is some like, you know, is that, what is it, left brain, right brain thing? I don't know. Like,
yeah, yeah. Right, it's not for us. We don't go there.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah. I mean, that can't be the case. And like, I will highlight to you why I think this whole communication thing is so important. I give it to our Minister of Health here in the Bahamas. I have no idea if it's him or if he is like managing or like there's other people managing his page. Literally, there have been so many rumors and misinformation going out across WhatsApp. WhatsApp news is what I'm calling it. WhatsApp yeah. is what drives like right, misinformation in like global South countries and like LMICs.
Exactly. Tell me about my country.
Right? The amount of stuff I get through WhatsApp, and this is not attacking the platform, but just being like, who has the time to alter videos, to like put captions on things? Like, I just got something sent to me that said there was a media story about a person, a American who had come in on a cruise ship, who had who had symptoms of COVID-19 and that she mm-hmm. was being tested.
Mm.
Next thing you know, I got a WhatsApp message saying, oh God, Bahamas, the first case of COVID-19 is here. We need wow. to pray. And like, and I'm like, and I'm looking at like the like screenshot, and like the screenshot caption of the video says, American tourist being tested for COVID-19. Being tested. Being tested. It's not saying wow. confirmed. It's not anything like that. And they've already said that.
That's even like, I have just from yesterday a good example, like on WhatsApp, somebody just posted this that, oh, my dear Nigerians, COVID, the virus stays for 4 days on the throat. So make sure like you could drink salt, vinegar, and
wow.
Yes.
And I mean, I was like, what? And this is something people would believe. That's the yes. same case of Ebola. People were baiting with salt, drinking salt. Mm-hmm. So I do not know how they have time to do this. I quickly replied, I was like, please take this down. Don't share it. It has no scientific evidence. Don't do this to people.
Right? Right?
But, yeah.
And then the That's... last thing as well. Sorry about this, Annie. I just have to say this, right?
Yes, there, of course.
Right, right. There's also been like persons who, I don't know if it's because of cynicism in governments, just around the world, right? People are just so cynical of their governments, and then the government is hiding stuff from them. And like part of this is like, I think maybe like a, I would say like part of it is driven by like racism. And I'm going to say this why, because like people have been saying, do you really trust the information coming out of China because of the style of government, right? But then you also saw people saying like, I saw where a video was altered, where our WHO rep in the Bahamas was giving an update on like COVID-19, and like coughed, and then she said in the video that this isn't, you know, COVID-19, but the person's like altered the video to make it look like she coughed, took out that comment, did like a pan to our CMO to like make it look like she was scared of the person, of the WHO rep coughing, and to make it look like the minister like backed away from the WHO rep to say, oh, I guess the WHO rep has COVID-19, and that one was spreading.
Wow.
So guys, I do need to go to work.
Sorry. Yes. We will speed this
up. So I don't know if we can. Yeah, I was hoping to finish before the hour. So I do need to run.
That's fine.
Can we finish this another day, or do you want to? Can you record the conclusion message without me or something?
One more thing, Annie, and just then we could continue with Charles and finalize.
I guess just additional points that I wanted to bring across is that a lot of this pandemic outbreak, you know, even the word that you use for it has been very political, you know, when is it being called a pandemic? But mm-hmm. also the politics, at least from where we see it, from here in Australia, is that it has affected which countries were on our high-risk lists, which determine our criteria for testing. So mm-hmm. because of our relationship with the US, they weren't put on the high-risk list until far too late. And so we weren't routinely testing for symptomatic return travellers from the US, which drove a lot of our new cases and spread. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I wanted to say. And I guess the other thing was that one of our senior researchers also recently spoke to us about thinking about the real cause of the disease, you know, what's behind all of this, because as you know, in Australia, we had terrible bushfires and people could identify climate change mm-hmm. very quickly as being the bigger global driving force behind why we're having more and more severe bushfires. But in terms of why we're having more and more severe epidemics coming out of a place like China, you know, people quite often point the finger towards the Chinese people and go, oh, it's because of the way they slaughter and eat animals, the way mm-hmm. that they keep animals in cages a lot. It's the way they raise chickens. But we also need to appreciate that there are so many global financial and trade pressures that lead people into keeping chickens at, you know, like in cages at that kind of a distance. And, you know, and in many ways, global trade and global finance probably help with our farm, with these farming practices and these animal transport practices that may have led to the onset of this virus and to the onset of future epidemics that might come out of a setting like this. So I guess those are the things that I wanted to highlight, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, listeners, I have to go to work now. I have to go back to the COVID bunker. So, yes.
Thank you so much, Annie.
Yeah, thank you for having the time to discuss
this. No worries. See you later, guys.
See you later, Annie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I mean, building up on the point that Annie just made about blaming like the Chinese market, I was watching this YouTube video, and maybe that's something we could also... I was by a journalist that went to explore the wet markets in China. I think I shared that video with you, Charles, did I or not?
I don't remember getting it, but okay. I think I've seen it shared around. I just haven't watched it.
Yeah, okay. And then like we're looking at that video, it's easy for you to just be like, oh, why the hell are these people like keeping animals like this? What are they doing with these wild animals and keeping them close to each other? And yeah, but then you have to also think, what is driving them? I mean, it's just, it should be, people would not just want to keep a snake, a wild fox, whatever in one place. Yeah. It should be a lot of things driving like the, as Annie said, it's global trade, it's capitalism, it's just so much demand and from people. So we also need to question ourselves, how have we gotten to the point that this is something that is acceptable, you know? So this is not just about what we see, but the underlying factors that are hidden. So let's start asking our questions.
I agree.
Ask ourselves questions, yeah.
I agree with that. I think at the end of the day, if COVID-19 hasn't shown us anything, is that health issues are not just confined to local borders. Health issues are global issues.
Yeah.
And that it's important that solidarity is shown across the world.
Exactly.
In terms of our healthcare systems, because exactly. When one healthcare system fails, mm-hmm. it could impact and have ripple effects across the entire world. And like, I think that this power dynamics mm-hmm. that have been going around with COVID-19 mm-hmm. is something that I think should be explored, particularly in terms of how quickly people were. Like, for me, I'm not gonna comment on like any country's governance system. Yeah. What I do think is that people, I remember, criticized the Chinese government in terms of saying, "Oh wow, they're cracking down and like being very like." I've heard the term, not my term, people, brutal in terms of how self-isolating quarantine measures were being put in place, emergency measures were being put in place to stem the tide. Yeah. And that because of maybe persons' perceptions of how the government is ran, people are like, I don't trust that these rates, that this curve is being flattened mm-hmm. in the amount of new cases. But mm-hmm. the reality is that the same things that China is doing now has now to be implemented in other countries that people were like, this is unbelievable. There's yeah. no way we'd ever have a state quarantine. And now you're seeing Spain just shut down today. Italy, of course, going on.
Denmark shut down 12 o'clock today. Well, so right? we're like, yeah, better right? control. Yeah.
And it's being hinted that regions of the U.S. will start to be shut down. Mm-hmm. And then potentially, you know, the entire, like, U.S., right? And like,
yeah.
I would be very interested to see how people will perceive this quote unquote taking away their liberty to move around in the case of like a public health perspective. And I guess the reason how come I'm bringing this up is when you think about how quickly, I guess, travel bans were put in place for China.
Yeah.
People didn't really bat an eye about it, mm-hmm. right? From my opinion, people didn't really bat an eye. They're like, yes, the disease is there. We need to ban. You can't come here, right?
Exactly.
But then people started, it's the fear of the other, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, right, in the Caribbean, it wasn't most of the cases that have been linked to coronavirus in the Caribbean have actually come from Italy, mm-hmm. right? So to me, it's just like, you didn't think about banning travel from Italy because of some, in my opinion, and maybe people might challenge me on this. Personally, I think that there's this Eurocentric view mm-hmm. on how we value the importance of like global North, particularly North American and European tourist travelers, markets, etc., that we didn't think about going so quickly to implement the type of measures that were implemented quickly against China because of viewing China as the other. But because of your lack of perception in seeing that, yes, Europe is not an epicenter of COVID-19 and people mm-hmm. didn't see it fast enough. Now mm-hmm. other parts of the world are being impacted by that. And I think it was very much around dynamics in terms of how we view Euro North American personnel in a more positive light than Asian yeah, persons.
Exactly.
And I know that sounds very, very controversial, but that's what I believe.
I mean, even the time that it took to like stop flights from Italy, I mean, that's something they could say. It's like, oh yeah, we have it all under control. But that was what led the spread to be more like, we saw a lot of cases in Germany, in like Denmark, because I mean, they were just thinking, yeah, I think Italy has it on lockdown, you know, we are Europe, we are like, but yeah, not to make conclusions, but I think a lot of things could have been done faster. But I also think that's something like Tedros has been mentioning recently, that countries need to see the urgencies, like political decisions need to be made towards this pandemic, because if countries are not reacting as they should, then things would not change in light of containing the disease itself. But yeah, so I mean, that's going back to the politics that Annie mentioned. I always remember this quote by, I don't know if you remember, from our first, one of our classes by Simon Rushton in Sheffield, and he was always that there's nothing more political than health. Yep. So we always have to think, no matter about the solidarity, the equity, there's always a political perspective. And till we health people start acknowledging this political aspect of health and working towards how we can better equip ourselves to speak that language, I do not think we will be able to get people to listen to us, because it should be that there is this, like, countries only always think about economic. I mean, I saw a paper that was talking about the economic cost of pandemic of COVID-19, and I'm like, yeah, like we always place more importance to the economics of things, but not looking at the fact that we need healthy people to drive economics.
Yep.
So I guess this is a good picture to show people, like, it really, and that's why I'm saying I'm happy, it really emphasizes the importance of public health. And I hope we learn a lot of lessons from this, from this part.
I agree with that. I think to like, just like bookend that, is that I would challenge every single public health person to really push for initiatives that we've been calling for ages, things that are the social determinants of health. We need to be able to ensure, like, to me, no country should be questioning whether or not universal health coverage should be a thing, because that's what's going to help to stem the tides of being able to address diseases in the long run. No country should be arguing about creating more social safety nets, paid leave, family leave,
redefining even work policies that will help people to have like life work balance. Like, these are things that it's all boils down to healthy living. So we need to start addressing these issues one by one. And it's sad that we had to get to a pandemic for all our, as they would say in the Nigerian proverb, I have to say this in Pidgin, "Fowl yash don't open." It means that finally you could see like the chicken ass. So stop, not to use that vulgar language, but it's really like finally now everybody's exposed, you know, like, and we have to rethink, redesign how we have been, or from us in the health systems part, how we have been addressing all this health systems issue, the languages we have been speaking. I mean, something like the IHR, like the implementations of it, we just thought, okay, because countries ratified it, they have put systems in place, which turns out, okay, that's not the issue, that's not the situation. So we have to really, you know, go to the roots of things, and this is an opportunity I see to really push for that change.
I agree with that. And I think that for every single person that's out there, I think that it's time, let's take into account the work being done by public health practitioners. I do not, like, we care about the safety of the people we serve. And so try to understand the measures that we're taking in order to help protect public health. And that once we move past this pandemic through the like worst parts of it, let's see how we can galvanize around social issues that are important. Because again, I remember another meme as well, and I have to say I was trying to find it. It was talking about what this pandemic has shown is that your work could have been done remotely, You didn't need to be in office to do most of the stuff that you did. You can get paid family leave, and that all of these things can happen. And for those particularly who are viewers in America, I know that you, this might sound a bit controversial. I'm not here trying to tell you how to vote or what to do, but I think this that you really, really, really need to consider about how are you the one of the few countries in the global north that does not have some of these like critical instances in place where people aren't walking away from quarantines and having $1,000, $2,000, $5,000 bills and not having family leave and being attached to these issues. Like, you need to be able to try and like push for your government at a national, local, and at a local, state, and national level to address and prioritize these issues, because otherwise we're gonna have a repeat of these same things. And I think it's
how we used to think before, oh, it's not possible and things, but now we are in a situation where we can't see it's possible. I mean, people, and I do agree, it is possible. We just have to reset our mindsets to this, and like, imagine if we end up having to work from home for the next 4 months or something. We will do it, people. It will thrive. So let's think more in that light. The world is changing. We have the technology that allows us to do things like that. Mm-hmm. And so how do we make the best use of it, I would say?
Yep.
And I would really say maybe it will do us justice maybe to dedicate this podcast to the healthcare workers out there, Charles, because I mean, we have been talking about them a lot and our public health people. So yeah, that might be a good way to say thank you for your hard works and all the efforts you've been putting.
Definitely. Thank you so much for everything that you've been doing and for putting your life, you know, on. Let me rephrase that. Thank you for everything that you've been doing and for, you know, prioritizing the public and working around the clock and doing our best to try and contain and mitigate the impacts of COVID-19. I think I'm going to try wrap up now. There was just one more thing that I just wanted to like bring up. And like perhaps some of this behind the scenes or whatnot. But there was something that I was, I remember now. This whole moderate incremental change where it's like, oh, this is too difficult to do, we can't do it. Don't believe it, right? Yeah. Because it was shown very quickly. Mm-hmm. I again, sorry folks, for those of you who are listening and hearing me pick an American context, they are my neighbor, and so what they do influences here. There's always this question coming up about how will you be able to pay for Medicare for all and for universal health coverage in the U.S.? It's going to cost trillions of dollars. How are you going to pay for it? Nobody questioned. Like, you know, everybody questioned that and drilled it to the like bone. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. just dumped $1.5 trillion to help prevent stocks from tanking. And nobody asked.
Wow.
Nobody asked. How are you going to make that money back up? How are you going to pay for that? And the money disappeared. Like, the stock market.
I
went up for like 30 minutes and then crashed again.
I remember I was watching Trevor Noah, who was asking, where did the money go? But how did they get the money back? You know, like, this is a question, it's a matter of priority. And that's what I'm saying, Charles, that we health people need to see the importance of our work and need to make this other sector see that without us, and without health, you are basically nowhere. Mm-hmm. So we need to really redesign the language narrative that, oh, we need all those sectors to make health work. It's the other way around. And people need to see that it's important to invest in health. It's important to put aside money for health. Because if there's no health, there's no any other thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So definitely that's something to think about. If there's money that could be brought out of nowhere to help the stock market, there will be money to make health work and push for universal health coverage.
Additionally, talking about the politics, nationalism, racism bit, I'm gonna have to try to find a way to like edit this stuff in. I hope that people who are seeing this outbreak happen and have been stockpiling and have been putting things together recognize that I really hope that you have empathy for people who have to move as refugees and navigate from difficult situations because their country is under some existential threat and that you don't judge them because what you're doing right now is exactly what those persons are trying to do. They're trying to pull things together to live a better life and that we shouldn't be judging people who are trying to escape from some type of hardship, because that's what other people are doing right now. They're leaving countries that have an outbreak and trying to run back to theirs, or like leave their country to go to somewhere else where it's better. I just really hope that this will teach people to be a bit more empathetic about people that we see who are doing things in desperation. People do not take the risk to travel across the seas in out of sheer whim. On a whim. They just don't do that on a whim.
Exactly. They just don't do that because it's possible. Like, oh yeah, I just feel like moving through all this hardship and like just going, just taking a ride on the Mediterranean Sea. Because, yeah. So that's actually that. I mean, there's so much lens, like there's so much, there's a whole spectrum to this like pandemic, which I hope people are now thinking about like how it is, because there's so much to like empathize with people. There's so much to bring back the concept of solidarity and like standing for one another. There's so much like fighting for what should be, you know? So I just see this, like if people see it for me, like from my view, as an opportunity to really lead transformational change in how we perceive and do things. It's just like we should learn from this.
Agreed. A lot. So, I guess I don't really know how to properly conclude, Naomi.
Yeah, I think
it's, I need some time to like really like reflect.
There was one point I wanted to mention, and for some terms of health systems, you know, like this whole the paper we read about social distancing and hygienic measures.
Yep. But
then how does that work for low middle income countries where like their whole livelihood is like thriving in social interaction?
Yeah.
And fragile health systems that cannot cope with it. So somewhere like Nigeria, we already have Lassa fever, and then if you come with COVID, where would which hospital would people go? We are about 200 million people. So there's so much ways to look at this COVID thing. It's like, yeah, but I think the summary of the story is a lot of work is being done and will continue to be done. So, which is something that says a lot about human being and our ability to thrive and push and be resilient. So let's continue in that light, but learning from our mistakes and not forget, because I guess something about us again is we like to repeat history, right? So let's remember this always and try to learn from it, I would say. Otherwise,
no, go ahead.
No. I'm just saying otherwise, then the whole ton of events will just be a waste of resources and capacity of people.
It would it would be a disservice to the to the thousands of lives that were lost if we do not learn from the actions or the inaction that's been taken during this pandemic. And shift our systems and ways of operations to ones that are rooted in solidarity, that prioritize people's health and prioritize people over profits, because that's what I think it is. Like
Exactly.
I have to tie this into climate change. Like there's a lot of people who are saying, what if climate change, which is an existential threat, was treated in the same light that COVID-19 was being treated right now? And the fact that when Wuhan went into lockdown, you saw, and like other places in China went into like lockdown, you saw the decrease in pollution, like it's like air satellites that like did like a satellite overview of parts of China before lockdown and during the lockdown. And like the before lockdown photo was like red dark spots over over the cities, and afterward it's like light blue slash clear because people aren't like, you know, driving, people aren't like consuming as much, and it tells me that we can make changes to how we organize ourselves in our countries to address the climate crisis, but we choose not to because it's inconvenient.
But that's the truth, Charles. I mean, I read this paper once, and I wish I could remember. We'll put it also in the link. It was about how if we really do want to address the climate crisis, we as a, what I call it now, as a species or human beings, we have to be ready to make drastic changes and sacrifices. But because they are not convenient for us, we try not to do. So here comes a pandemic that shows us that we have to. So that means it is possible because we have adapted, we have adjusted. So that means the same. So if we can treat climate change with the same urgency, it all comes back to urgency, as COVID-19, we will be living in a better planet in a few years, you know?
Agreed. Agreed. So, so to wrap up, this has been a really interesting conversation around COVID-19. We've offered critiques and we've offered solutions for some of the ways in which this pandemic has been handled. We think it's important that we take the time to address inequalities and we look how health systems are able to improve in their ability to cope. But we need to be able to try and find more opportunities to engage with the media and how we leverage opportunities in traditional and the social media space. And that political will is going to be absolutely required for us not to address COVID-19, but other urgent crises that that are going to impact our lives, from the next outbreak to climate change. We're all one race, the human race, and that we can't allow these divisions between us leave us divided. And I'm looking forward to seeing how we can move forward in a solidarity approach to address some of the other social issues, because this is public health. And without health, you do not have countries functioning, you do not have communities thriving, and you do not have global trade. So hopefully you've enjoyed this conversation, folks. And we just want to encourage you to be safe. Get media information from your local authorities. Support your local health worker, either through sending them messages or dropping off coffee or doing these things that help them feel appreciated. Just remember to be nicer people. I don't know, Naomi, is there anything else you want to like?
No, I mean, from my side, I would say it's just that we just need to really think behind the principle of solidarity. And as you said, Charles, let's be nice to people. Let's also believe that we can change when we want to. So let's put that at the back of our minds.
Exactly. So take care, folks. And remember, addressing pandemics, this is a public health issue.